to Thursday, or were it Monday, Tuesday, Friday, or something
Thursday,
like that.
Thursday, Friday. That would be quite rogue, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be rogue, but it will be a way to target a candidate pool that other people want, because there's going to be some people actually prefer having a midweek break. So I've got a friend of mine who works for the civil service, and that's what he does. He basically takes, so the civil service, I think at a certain level, you can actually take 4 days. They've had it for ages where you can do 4 days rather than five. And if you choose that, you can actually have a free day, but you can then move that free day whenever you want. And he always chooses Wednesday. And his philosophy is, look, I don't want to work any more than 2 days in a row. And I totally get that. Yeah, I totally get that, because Monday, Tuesday, right? Big break Wednesday, nothing happening, then Thursday, Friday, and then big break again with the weekend, and suddenly, you know, the stress levels kind of might go down. So yeah, it's maybe something you could try. Definitely. Anyway, folks, we are live, everybody. We're live, everyone. It is Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 155. Bit of a change of scene. I need to apologize for this background. I am in a hotel room, and I'm actually trying to get some decent lighting here, which is why I've kind of manufactured a stand, which is going to topple over at some point during the course of this call. So I apologize in advance. But I'm very excited to have this conversation, because it's been on my mind for a long time. And I think it's been on your mind as well. How to move to salary transparency. It's been like a big thing. It's been kind of, the momentum has been building on this for the last 18 months. So we're going to have a fantastic conversation about this. And we're looking forward to everyone's comments and the insights from our guests. Firstly, let's do a quick sound check, as we always do. Again, it's kind of a change of operations. I haven't got my speaker either. So, my mic, sorry. So I need to just check whether you can hear me okay. So for the folks on Crowdcast, you can hear me okay, just let me know in the chat. We should be multicasting this on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter. So if you can hear me in those places, just give me some indication. I think LinkedIn have actually given us a new emoji. So why don't you press that and let us know whether you can hear me okay on my LinkedIn. And then we'll be able to just be sure that audio is going to be okay. Okay, thank you, Jessica. Very kind of you to say. Matt can say as well. Okay, great. Okay, quick word to our sponsors. By the way, folks, none of these shows will happen without our sponsor support. So I want to thank one of our most consistent sponsors, been on Brain Food Lab in the last 3 years. It is Daxtra.com, one of the venerable big data companies that's going to help you basically refresh your moribund candidate data. So if you have a massive kind of backlog, you've got a database of candidates that you haven't spoke to for ages and you want it refreshed, Daxtra, the kind of company that might be able to help you do that. So make sure you check them out. It's daxtra.com. I'll share the link into the chat stream a bit later. Okay, so let's get on with it. Welcome, firstly, to Annie Jackson. Annie, great to see you back on the show, and thank you for being co-host today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Great stuff. Annie, for the folks actually who don't know you, can you maybe be useful to quickly introduce yourself, like who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So currently head of talent for a company called Clio. We're a 170-person fintech scale-up, headquartered in the UK, but most of our customers who use Clio are based in the US. We're an app-based product. It's an AI-powered chatbot, very much geared towards Gen Z millennials, really helping them to build good credit and build savings and kind of cut their spending as well. So kind of very much focused on fighting for the world's financial health. And prior to Clio, I was a talent lead at CarWow, which is like a sort of automotive tech company in Europe, hiring for their sort of product and non-tech teams.
Fantastic. Quick segue. Can you remind me who the technical co-founder was for Clio?
Oh, I don't actually know. I know the CEO, Barney, but I think he left way before me. I think his name's Greg, maybe, or something like
okay.
that.
Okay, I don't know. I, for some reason, I'm pretty sure I know him, because I might just randomly bump into him in, as you do, in the shortish kind of way. And he was banging on about this product. I thought, yeah, I'll keep an eye on that. And now suddenly, as you were kind of giving that monologue, I thought, hang on, I might know the dude who built this.
Rings a bell,
anyway,
yeah.
yeah. Anyway, they're going great, so check them out. All right, Annie, great to see you on the show. We always kick off with a bit of like a review of the newsletter from last week. So did you read it, and if so, what was interesting for you?
Yeah, definitely. Like, such a big fan of the newsletter. It's definitely sort of part of my sort of Sunday ritual. Nice big cup of coffee, have a little read through. But I think first off, the blog that sort of really stood out to me was Teresa's blog around running sourcing sessions with the wider business, really getting everyone involved in sourcing. You know, sourcing so, you know, it's just such a big part of the role, particularly if you're hiring for a startup. So getting everyone involved from the leadership team through to, you know, your interns, really gamifying it. I loved that she kind of had prizes for the best sourcing messages and the highest quality sourcing sort of profiles that they found as well, which was really, really smart. And yeah, I think, you know, at Clio, we've seen when you get the leadership team and people like that involved in sourcing and sending those messages, it has such a big impact on message acceptance rate and like response rate as well, generally. So definitely going to be poaching those ideas and using them at Clio, to be fair. But yeah, I just really like the way it was written, and like the sort of tone was great. Loved it.
I agree. Teresa did an amazing job. I actually didn't know Teresa, but basically I've managed to persuade her to turn up to Brain Food Live next month to talk exactly about this.
Oh, amazing.
So we're going to get together a bunch of people who've actually put it into practice, like how to organize a sourcing jam. So the entire idea behind this post is to say, you know what, a recruiter's one person, you can work very, very hard, but you're only ever going to do one person's worth of work. Imagine if you could get like 10% of recruitment effort from other people in your business, software engineers, product managers, C-level, if they were just applied a little bit of their network and a little bit of their effort to the task, how much faster would you be able to pipeline this type of talent, particularly as it's their network that you need to get involved in the first place. Although she really not only performed a really interesting sort of project, but also wrote it up in such a way that was quite inspirational for us to follow. So thank you, Teresa, for that. And we're going to get Teresa onto the show. So make sure you register for that. It's already up on my channel. So check that out and register on that. It's going to be a good one to do. Okay, cool. What else is interesting for you, Annie?
Yeah, I think that the second blog that really stood out was the one around death of company culture. I think it said something like only 60% of employees aged between 18 to 24 believe that a company's culture was important. And I think that for me was quite surprising. I thought it would be way higher. So yeah, it just really goes to show that like the attitude of younger workers to company culture is definitely a lot more different for those aged 25 and above. So yeah, that definitely shook me. It was surprising. And then the second stat that I saw in there was that sort of 79% of job seekers say that they are likely to use social media in their job search, and that goes up to 86% for younger job seekers. I'm seeing a lot of companies in the UK in particular doing a really good job of employee advocacy and getting their employees to really talk a lot about the company, what they're doing well, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Glassdoor. And I think that's something that we could do a lot more at Clio, particularly given that our kind of company brand isn't as well known in the UK. Just getting our kind of name out there on Twitter is just so important, I think, and LinkedIn as well, of course.
Yeah, two things there. I'd be interested to know, what's your theory as to why younger people think culture is less significant or less important?
It's an interesting one. I guess I as a recruiter always really struggle to define what a company culture is like. So when people are like, oh, what's the company culture like at Clio? Yeah, a company could say they're doing one thing, but it could be completely different, like the actual day-to-day living of it. So yeah, maybe it's more around that they just don't trust companies in the way that they talk about their culture publicly. But yeah, I'd be keen to know what is important for those younger people in their job search, particularly given that we hire a lot of younger kind of people into Clio generally.
Yeah, it's you know, that's actually a topic. Again, every time I do a Brain Food Lab, I'm just immediately thinking that should be a topic of conversation. Like, what is the generational attitude to the concept of company culture? And is it something that is a bit legacy? Because is it something that people who have the experience of the office, do we bang on about culture? And then these younger people coming into the market, having had 2 years worth of remote living in wherever, do they now think actually culture is, you know, whatever, give me the compensation, give me some of those things. Yeah, I don't really care about the rest of it. So that's an interesting thing to talk about. Maybe time to bring that back. All right. Thank you very much, Stephen O'Donnell. I didn't realize you were here. Great to have your position. Get your camera on. I might bring you on later. Okay. Because we do want to have a debate on this. Okay, that's great stuff, Annie. Let's talk about this topic and get on with it and bring some of our guests on. Before we do that, why don't you tell us your experience of moving to salary transparency? Because I understand that's something that you've got direct experience of, Annie. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So at Clio, we have full transparency on salary bandings for all different levels at Clio. We use Progression app to build frameworks for every discipline at Clio. So engineering, product design, talent even. They have 5 levels and each level has a salary banding, which is shared publicly. So everyone at Clio knows which level we all are, and we all know kind of what the salary bandings for those levels are. And they're listed on our job ads as well. So it was a humongous piece of work for our HR team, kind of putting those together, benchmarking. Benchmarking is so important when you're doing that. I think we definitely, we were too slow to update our salary benchmark and bandings because we launched them, maybe took maybe a year and a bit to revisit them and re-update them. So that for us was definitely a bit of a learning that just you have to be so on it with updating them, especially when they're public. Definitely very keen on it. I think it's so important. I initially was quite reluctant to move to being fully transparent on salary bandings because I thought everyone would just ask for top of banding because of candidates when you're hiring. But I think it's just been so well received, particularly by candidates and our entire internal team as well. So I think very passionate about it. I think everyone should be doing it.
Right. So you've gone from a psychological position where you were initially skeptical to now having seen it in practice, you're now pretty much an evangelist to the idea, right? So you've had a conversion on it based on your experience that you've seen. That's a wonderful thing to think about. And you've already introduced one of the things that maybe, you know, people at home need to think about as well, this idea of benchmarking it. Mm-hmm. Benchmarking it, meaning market benchmarking, is that right? Like sort of going to the market and seeing what market average is and doing that type of work. Is that what you mean, Annie?
Yeah, absolutely. Just looking at sort of what everyone else is paying and making sure that we're paying fairly for the levels that we're offering as well.
Right. So there's two actions there, isn't it? To understand what the levels are. So we need to break down the jobs in terms of levels of seniority rather than lazy sort of labels to say senior this or senior that. Like, why is it senior? How have the responsibilities changed? Because you need to have that, otherwise you won't be able to bench properly. And getting into the market, and some people have already asked, like, what? How do you use the data? I guess that's, I don't know, was there a single source, or did you just have to dig into like government stats and stuff? I mean,
it's so hard because we typically benchmark against companies that are similar size to us, but then we do try and hire for companies that are much, much bigger than us. So I think, you know, kind of wanting to hire the very best from Meta, from Google, from DeepMind, but often they're on double, triple what we can actually pay. So that for me has been quite tricky, sort of balancing that and getting that right. Because I think, yeah, it's all well and good us benchmarking against a sort of similar sized 170 person company. But realistically, we want to hire the big dogs from Meta and Google and Facebook, but yeah, it's tough to get right for sure.
Final question for you before we bring our guests on as well to join this conversation, Annie. Why do you think, again, why do you think companies might be reluctant to go to salary transparency? Like, what do you think are the barriers to this?
I guess it's tough, particularly if you've got a bit of discrepancy there, or like legacy discrepancy, people on way more than others. I'm such an advocate for it. So I think if there are discrepancies, just fix them and then be public about the bandings. I think, yeah, it's something that everyone should be doing. It's a lot of companies moving towards it. So yeah.
Yeah, I wonder whether size has got an impact here as well. Like, for instance, it's one of those where, as you say, fix the discrepancy, but you can imagine that fixing is going to be more challenging the bigger you are as a business, for instance. Mm. 180 man person, 160 person business, you can fix a couple of that. Let's say 10%, 16 people, you've got to uplift. But if you times 100 and you've got 100,000 people that are on wrong salaries, then Maybe that's not even tenable. So there we go. Yeah, Annika said a few things. The size of the company. Let's deal with that. Folks, if you have any questions for our guests, by the way, use the ask a question function at the bottom of your screen. We're going to definitely get to that at the end of this conversation, because I think it's one of those where we're going to have a stack of questions, and we definitely want to investigate this. For folks who are watching this on the social networks, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter, if you just add a comment in your questions, I'm going to try and get to those, and we'll be able to deal with that at the end of the show. Okay, let's bring on our guests. Let's see what we've got to offer on this. We've got loads of people to bring on, so I might actually forget who's going to be on this thing. Stephen, I do want to bring you on, sir, so make sure you've got your makeup on, okay? Let's go with Jess first. Why don't we bring Matt on as well? Tell you what, I might just bring the job lot on, see whether we can. I think Crowdcast has actually increased the number of people we can get on screen, so it could well be that we've got loads of people we can bring on. Who's this? This is Matt, isn't it?
Good to see you.
Matt, how are you doing? Good to see you, man.
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. How are you both?
Good, very, very well. Matt, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Go for it. My name is Matt Bradburn. I'm one of the founders and CEO of People Collective. We are an HR consultancy that work with startups and scale-ups across the world to help them put in the foundations to be able to grow their business in terms of people ops. So think progression, leveling, total compensation and reward, equity, manager development, and more. And I've had the pleasure of knowing Hung and Annie for a very long time. So nice to see you both.
Cool. There's Jess with a dramatic entrance. As usual and as expected, Jessica, I would expect no less from you. Are you in New York, by the way, Jess? Have you moved yet or what?
Not yet. I move in 2 weeks' time, so I'm still in Amsterdam.
Oh, because it was very Broadway, your approach there. I'm going to be in New York next week. We're going to be ships in the night. We'll miss each other.
Such a shame. Next time.
Okay, Jess, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jess. I am the COO of a company called Whereby. We are a fully remote video communications platform. And you should definitely go check more of us out. I really care about compensation frameworks, and particularly procedural and substantive fairness when it comes to compensation. I wrote 3 blog posts about compensation called Approaching Pay a Bit Like Pricing, which talks about the kind of more commercial way to approach what I would say compensation's kind of underpinnings are. And those 3 blog posts, I think, have got a fair bit of traction over the last couple of months, which has been really nice to see. And that's it. That's me.
That's you. And by the way, Whereby, folks, is superior to Zoom. I will say that now, and I've said it for a long time. Go check it out, whereby.com, the number one video communication tool around. Zoom is yesterday's business. Okay, I saw Mick and he disappeared. Mick, switch your camera on. And Nicholas, I think he's going to come join us in a bit, but you know, fiddle with it as best you can. We're going to get on with the show as we go with it. You aren't here, Mick. You're not on screen. Can you switch on? All right, let's just get rid of, I'll remove and then re-invite. Okay, let's talk about this issue. I want to talk about why companies don't do this. And I want to be fair on those companies that are reluctant, because I don't think it's just bad people, right? So what are your views as to why companies might be reluctant to go to a salary transparent move? And let's not forget, rewind back 2.5 years ago, no one was going salary transparent apart from public sector. So this is a marginal idea that's suddenly becoming mainstream. What are the reasons why companies or organizations might be reluctant to move? So Matt, let's go with you on that question first.
Yeah, it's a good one. I think what we see, right, is like, it depends how you define transparent in the first place, right? Are we talking like fully open buffer, like let's show everybody everything? Doesn't matter whether you're, you know, the newest employee or the CEO, open it all up. Or are we talking like clear bandings, maybe a strong philosophy alongside that to show like, right, we made some equitable decisions around this. This is our approach. This is how we calculated it. And then the transparency there. I think we definitely still see a lot of reluctance to go with the former, which is kind of understandable, right? Like particularly as Brits and mostly working with Brits and Europeans. If I crossover, jump across the channel. In Europe, you've got a lot of issues around data security, data structure, sharing of personal information, etc. So we weren't even started on the legal aspects, right? In the UK, I think you've just got the classic British behavior, which is like, oh no, we can't be sharing this, awful. So that's one reason. I think for the second piece though, the reluctance tends to be far more related to, they're almost scared, right? They're like, are we going to lose people off the back of this? This is always the primary fear. Are we going to lose people? And that tends to be because there isn't actually enough equality in terms of how the salaries were calculated. So kind of root cause issue there. Or it tends to be simply because they're not used to it and haven't tried it, right? Like, I don't see it really going much deeper than that, although others might have a different view, which is like the fear of the new, like, oh gosh, what happens? Or we don't know what the outcome's going to be. And again, that worry and fear tends to come back to far more of an issue around like retention and development than anything else.
Right. So a couple of good points there, Matt. Number one, I think that the newness of it is definitely a thing, right? Because anything new is a risk, let's face it. It's a risk and an opportunity. But because it's basically, we've never done this, or the history of salary pay, we've rarely ever done this. It's very, very new. Therefore, it is potentially a risk. And that would stop enough. The fact that it's new will stop enough people from making that move. There has to be a big incentive, in other words, to encourage people to switch. And secondly, there may be a long legacy of pay inequity over time, based on whatever reason. I mean, it could just be discrimination, or it could just be companies, you know, trying to get best value bang for buck, so to speak. But over time, that accrues to such a situation where you've got complete variability in terms of who gets paid what, and you can't expose that, because if you do that, oh my goodness, you then have a lot of explaining to do. We don't want to let that sleeping dog lie. It's still a situation for a lot of companies. Okay, Jess, just go to you. Have you got a contribution to make there? Reasons why companies won't?
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to my team about this actually, because we at Web, I have a transparent pay philosophy, which I'll share in the chat in a second. But the way that we do it is we have a threshold. So there's like a minimum that we'll pay you, and then we have a kind of small buffer that we allow people to move within, depending on skills, personal circumstances, blah, 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 right? So pretty much I think everyone in our company could guess what someone else is being paid, like within 10%, and they'd be like 95% correct. So the question when we first implemented this, the kind of pushback that we were getting was really about like, oh, well, you know, there's a couple of like historic things we need to clean up. We need to make sure we're really on top of this. We need to make sure it works. And then when it works, then we can be more, you know, thoughtful about what's next. And I kind of got asked a question the other day, like, are we ready? Can we just go to individual level of salary? Like, why aren't we doing that? And I couldn't think of like what my pushback was anymore. I was like, well, we kind of already went within 90%, so maybe we should just do it. But the answers that I did have to why not that level of individual salary transparency were cultural differences. We are a fully remote company, and there are very different cultural perspectives on how a salary should be shared. You rightfully mentioned, British people are a little bit more unforthcoming with these kinds of direct pieces of information. But we, you know, employ people from all over the world that have very different approaches to salary transparency. The second one was really around new starters and making sure that they feel included when they come into the team. I think that there's quite a big chance that someone could find this quite jarring, entering a company where there's already so much different, and then also like having to come to grips with the fact that their salary is going to be publicly shared to the entire company or even to the world, like in Buffer. And then the third one is like kind of what I think is a shit argument, if I'm allowed to say that. But like, it's kind of like, well, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? If we're already so close to that, and like we're basically, everyone's pretty happy and our compensation feedback is very positive, then like, why would we go any further into the kind of great unknown? So that's our current pushback. And I think that probably a lot of people would say that's probably fairly similar to what they're feeling if they're already kind of in the transparency game. But if you're completely outside of the transparency game, then you know the arguments are very different. But I think that's the perspective I'm going to take today.
Yeah, very, very interesting. By the way, I hope people are making notes. Someone make notes on all of this, because I think there's loads of stuff that's already been shared here that really needs to be recorded, documented, and you know, hopefully there's some sort of guide sheet we can produce at the end of this. Okay, Mick, we've got you on screen. Nicholas, keep trying. We'll get you. I'll maybe do the same thing, reject and bring you back. But Mick, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Yeah, sure. So can you hear me okay? Everyone
yep,
got me?
Yeah, all good.
Awesome. So yeah, Mick Griffin from Trafford. So I'm from Trafford ATS, so from the HR tech side. Very, very thankful that Hung that you invited me. Of course, one side is that we are very involved in like the HR space anyway in learning, but the other side is that even as an individual company, we are practicing complete salary transparency as well.
Yeah, and you moved to salary transparency sort of it's sort of from one position to the next. So we're going to dig into this in a bit more. Oh, here's Nicholas as well. There he is, finally.
Hey.
Nick, how are you doing?
Doing fine. Very happy. Sorry for the delay. I just got a crash at the worst possible moment.
No worries. It's like live show, man. This is how it happens. All part of the excitement. Nick, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Sure. I'm in charge of HR at 360 Learning. 360 Learning is an LMS, so learning management system that focuses on collaborative learning as a way of learning. And I've been there for about 3 years. The company is now 380 people scattered across the world because we're a full remote organization, but with the most of our team being in France, the US and the UK.
Okay, fantastic stuff. And you've got obviously experience also of moving to this position, haven't you, Nicholas? So this is great to get your insight and input. A couple of things I want to raise straight away. I think, Matt, you first raised this, and Jess, you touched on it as well. There are kind of challenges with regards to jurisdictions and legal sort of situations, right? Because certain companies or certain areas of the world might perceive salary transparency as an intrusion of privacy. Because if I join a company that is, you know, saying, hey, this is what we're going to pay, they're going to connect me to that data. That's connecting my personal identity to this. That may contravene some sort of law, in which case certain organizations may be prevented from going to this salary transparency, to the extreme level of salary transparency as a flavor. And indeed, what is the challenge where you have a single employee in those places where one policy at a global level may actually have a different issue? Yeah, you're going to have a couple of people might actually be put into a difficult position. So this is more complicated already than I realized. And it may take a little bit of talking through to compute this. But let's talk about the different types of transparency that they might be, because it could be I'm coming at this thinking it's binary, but actually there's different flavors. So what are those flavors? Does anybody want to kind of give us a little bit of a landscape as to what type of salary transparency modes you can operate with? Any thoughts on this? I'll open it to everyone.
Well, I can go ahead and say sure. The levels that we've seen at Whereby. So there's what I consider like individual level transparency, which is like people are named either by role or by like literally like Hung is paid X. And that can either be fully public, which is the most extreme, I would say, on the spectrum. So you literally have this sheet available to the world, Buffer, for example, or it can be just internal. So the company itself has access to that information, but this is not something that you share externally to candidates or, you know, people out in the market. Then you would have transparency down to bandings. So you can see within a range of what people being paid in various roles and various levels. You can then have a kind of level of transparency in that, like, do you make people's levels available to be visible to other members of the team? Can they kind of guess, or is it directly like they can just do the math themselves? Then you would have kind of transparency for job families. So like this is roughly what we pay. If in engineering, our salaries range from 50,000 to 110,000, and there's no detail of those bands or levels. And then you would have like what is a fairly opaque system. So things are completely private internally. I would say that's kind of what it is. And then there is a kind of whole world of the compensation philosophy and how transparent you are with that, right? The compensation philosophy, yeah, I would almost say is a kind of slightly different conversation, because that is around like, you know, how do you calculate things like cost of living? How do you factor in things like, you know, bonuses, commission, all of those bits and pieces? And that comp philosophy, I think you can almost have the exact same argument of level of transparency. Do you have super high level detail of even the data set that you're using? So whereby we make our data set available. So people, it's in one password, anyone can log in and see where we're getting our data from. But some companies may just have the bandings and say, we're not going to be transparent about where we get these bandings. We calculate them, you have to trust us, end of story. And other companies might have a really detailed level of transparency on them too.
That's a really good overview. Folks, everyone else who's on the panel, do you have anything to add to that sort of breakdown of how the different types of transparency we've got on the table? Is there anything missing that, or anything that you'd like to add to what Jess has just said?
Yeah, I'd love to. I think the only other piece I've seen was the slight nuance to that system was one we applied at Peakon, which is where we had like it literally calculated a fixed number per role. So that was about the only difference. So we got to a point of like a clarity around a number, and anybody could access that calculator. So it went even deeper than a band, and the decision was taken very early as a company that they were like, we want to be super transparent about this. This is back in like 2016, and any offers we put out, it was that number and that number alone. If you didn't want to take that number, that's fine. And we were happy to walk away from that because it meant that it really from day one pushed the kind of equality piece, because there was no argument. You couldn't get the CRO being like, oh, but we really want this person. They just want that little 5K more. So I think that's the only other version I've seen. But yeah, Jess gave a great overview.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Go ahead, Mick.
Yeah, if just only from my side, I think, we kind of at Traffic, we went down like the buffer route, like Jess mentioned, like we are like the full transparency, like per position, per person kind of thing, like publicly. But I think I just approached this from the other side, that I kind of like where I'm drawing the line is more like, I don't think that, I think it's great that companies are starting to put even salary bands in job descriptions, but I don't think we're at a level where we can call that salary transparency. So that's a great start, but anything above that, like, so it's more like for me setting like the bottom line rather than how far we can go. And I just think like, you know, salary bands in job titles alone and job descriptions alone is great, but it's like, we can still, I think the benchmark is still a little bit higher. So I think that's where I set like my line.
Yep, that's fine. And I think we do definitely want to talk about the internal and external. But I think we've got some sort of idea as to what the options are. Because I think there's people listening in here that are probably, you know, haven't made that decision yet. Just looking at the poll there, it looks like most people are discussing it, but they haven't actually pulled the trigger. They need to know what are the options. So the options are, look, you can go down to the individual. So make sure, so basically you can work out per name what this person is on. Do you want that? Or you can attach it to a role or a set of roles. So this is the banding side, which I think most companies are probably trying to do, to say this job or these this job will have this range, but you can't identify individuals in that particularly. You can go departmental. So you can say job family, to say this group of businesses or this type group of roles has this sort of banding. Or you can go through increasingly opaque ways, right? So that's when you start moving to the point where, you know, you are looking only external publication perhaps, where you're saying, you know, what, generally speaking, we're paying this amount and put a big band on it. And, we've seen that in public sector a lot, where the banding is actually quite wide. And actually, what does that mean? Because it basically means you could just oscillate all the way through all of this stuff. It's like,
yeah,
what's going on?
20,000 to 80,000.
Right, like one way to get around it, like if you're obligated to do it, like let's face facts. I think sometimes a little bit of me thinks that it needs to be a voluntary move by the company to want to do this, because if you obligate the business, that's exactly what we'll do. They'll simply put ridiculously wide bands and say we're transparent, but they're not willing to do this. So we have to recognize that and actually also respect it rather than force it to happen. So okay, Nicholas, let's go to you, man. Can you tell us a little bit more about sort of the journey that 360 went through? Because I understand that you also went through a process of moving towards transparency, didn't you? So can you educate us a little bit about sort of how you made that position and where you've settled on currently?
So I think we talked about benchmarking. I mean, I heard at the beginning a discussion about the benchmarking and what that means. And one important aspect of benchmarking is you need to know what you're comparing. Right? And likewise, a very important part of transparency is you need to agree on what you pay. And so really the first very important step in salary transparency is transparency in levels from my perspective. And so being super clear, reaching a common understanding of what's a level, what's a one versus a two, what's a two versus a three, And getting that solidified before you start getting into the comp discussion, which is the easiest way to send everything sideways, because then it changes completely, right? People want to know how much they're paid. And if you give them that before you talk about the levels and what you want to pay in your company, you're not going to have a very good solid ground to move to transparency. And so really, I think the first year at 360 Learning was spending a lot of time discussing what are the criteria of impact and how do we define our levels. And we have 16 levels in the organization, which are now spread across 9 tiering of jobs within the organization, and all levels are transparent. But that first step of just making sure this is clear is extremely important.
I agree, by the way. I think leveling is like absolutely one of the most fundamental ingredients in compensation. I would say that like an even earlier and more important step is really like understanding like what are you actually trying to do in the market. The amount of times I've worked with founders and leaders, like I do a lot of consulting on compensation, who are really excited and ready to dive into like the tactics of compensation, but they have, you know, no idea who they're actually trying to attract, or like at what level, like, you know, what level of seniority versus like leverage do they want to have? Like, what's the ROI that they want on their headcount? And these are the kinds of things that they, you know, I think founders and CEOs really need to think about before they start getting HR teams to go and do the tactics of comp. Because otherwise HR teams are just going to be saying like, well, we want to be paying at the 75th percentile, I guess, based out of the country that we're headquartered. Like that, like really being able to understand like, what are you strategically trying to attract as a business and retain and try to get to is like the most important first question to ask, in my opinion.
That may be true, but I think we're also at the stage where there's some legislative sort of imperatives now. I mean, especially in the US, where they're saying, you know what, you need to publish this. So I think what's going to happen is a lot of companies are probably going to be dragged towards this without necessarily having a deep-seated commitment to it. And I think those companies need to be equipped with some options, because they need to backfill, if you like, the thinking. So let's talk about leveling. This seems like a big project, Nicholas. You mentioned a year it took at least to get this on. I mean, I presume the more complicated your business, the more difficult a project this is going to be. We had some people in the chat stream saying, yeah, company size is actually a massively important factor to this. So at what point does this become untenable to do? Because let's face it, who drives this? It's going to be some HRD, some CHRO, somebody like that. What is their longevity in a business? It's 3 to 5 years, something like that. Is this a job that you can squeeze in 3 to 5 years? I mean, maybe it's just too big for a certain business to ever do this. What is the optimal size to move from sort of a non-transparent to a transparent business? Is there such a number? And at what point do you think it becomes actually pretty unviable? Thoughts? Let's go around.
Do you want me to turn? I would love to dive in here.
Go.
Simply because we've done this so much over the last 3 years for so many different companies of all shapes and size, from like 20 people up to 2,500. 2,500, yeah, it gets pretty hard. But when you're like 20 people, 100 people, 200 people, yeah, sure, we're dedicating our time to the project, but it's like 3 months to level the whole company effectively and blend in the compensation piece as well is perfectly reasonable. When you start to get into like 400, 800, yeah, it can start to take significantly longer, because then obviously the politics starts to emerge and you get the problem with the stakeholders and no one's like doing what they're supposed to. You're herding cats, right? I think the earlier the better is good. Like when we've seen companies do this at like 20 people or 30 people, when we've kind of kept in contact with them down the line at 100 people, 200 people, they're like, I'm so glad we did it then and don't have to do it now, because they've been able to kind of build upon something. This is not to say like you've got to like create some sort of horrendous PwC document of 84 different pages of God knows what, right? Just starting with the basics like helps really well about kind of just setting the thinking and the groundwork around it. And it really is inextricably linked to comp. And we always recommend like do the leveling and the progression piece first before you start thinking about the compensation. If you do it the other way around, you really start to struggle.
It's almost like, you know, the best time to do it was 10 years ago. The second best time to do it is now. But it may already be too late for some businesses, because if you're like 150,000 person business, Like, how are you going to do that across multiple countries? It's like, that doesn't seem doable. So if you are basically sub 400, maybe the smaller the better, but at that size where more or less you might know everybody in the business, that is the time to do it. Any thoughts to share on this? I mean, is anyone going to have it? Go on, Nicholas.
Well, I think so. It also pays, and this is where the transparency is extremely valuable. It also pays to accept that things will change, right? And so the more transparent you are about how you got to the system you apply today, the easier it will be to apply changes to that when circumstances change. Because, I mean, you can roll out a leveling system to a 25,000 organization. I started in Comp and Ben in very large multinational organizations. And you can do that. It's just a multi-year project with lots of politics, as you said. But ideally, yes, you want to do it very, very early on in the life of your organization. That being said, it's certain that if you roll out your leveling and your comp policy in a company that's 50 people, you don't need 80% of the complexity that you will need when there's 200 of you, when there's 500 of you, when there's 1,000 of you, where you have different markets, a lot more jobs, a lot of levels, where the top levels of your organization won't be worth what they are now. And so you need to think about your leveling range as something that will stretch like an accordion as you grow. So it helps knowing where you're headed, but transparency in how you design the policy is very important to allow you to, without too much drama, adjust the policies as you grow.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Nick. Can I add? Yeah, just one thing as well I want to add is I think that, you know, size of company is not the only factor, because I think what happens is when you're moving to transparency, well, like companies that were not transparent but really took care of like the equality and stuff, they will make that transition easier. You can have a company with 50 people, but when they realize like, oh my goodness, that person is earning 20% more than the other at the same role. It's also a little bit, I think it's a little bit highlighting the healthiness of the structure pre-transparency. So definitely size is a huge factor, but let's also like the companies that will find this the most painful are the ones that probably have the biggest cracks to cover through transparency as well.
Yeah. They're the ones we need to help though, mate. They're the ones we need to help. Because the reality is, I think the vast majority of companies have simply accrued this. I think your term, Matt, people debt, right? You've accrued it over time. You've not had to deal with it because there was no pressure to do salary transparent. Yep. Every company I work for is salary non-transparent, you know? So this is a new thing. We got away with it. Now suddenly we can't get away with it. As Craig said, there's obligation in the US. They're getting pushed to this. And I think that's going to spread in different places. So very interesting to deal with. Let's look at the practical ways, some practical issues there. Akbar in LinkedIn, he said to you, Matt, but I'll direct it to everyone. Does it make sense to do it piecemeal department by department? Is that one way where we can kind of break this down so it's not like a big, universal thing? We can say, you know what, in sales, we're going to go here, and then in engineering, and then in whatever. Or maybe we start with us, start with recruiting. start with us. What are your thoughts on this? Is that the way in which you did it, particularly to Annie, Mick, and Jess, and Nick, actually? Did you go department by department or big bang everyone?
Yeah, I think for us, particularly for those much bigger teams like engineering, we've got the second biggest team in the company for us. It probably was a lot easier to level that such a big team and split them into five groups, level one to five. Whereas for very niche disciplines, like we've got two credit risk analysts at Clio, doing it for them is a lot of work for little value add. So we don't have levelings for them. So yeah, it's an interesting one, getting that right. And yeah, I guess the smaller the team, it's probably more difficult because there are discrepancies there. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
We wrote quite a comprehensive kind of general framework for our team, so from level one to level seven, and we then went through the entire company in one time. So one of the key things that we asked everybody to do that was a manager was really like get a good we understand there's a bit of a chicken and egg situation here, right? So we very much accepted that for the first year until our entire performance assessment cycle had been completed, there may be some things that we like probably had some levels we might need to change post-fact. We made it very clear to the team, very transparent up front. Like you may be leveled in a way that you don't necessarily agree with. We're going to try and be maybe a little bit more conservative. And if we have an issue, we'll try and do back pay. And we really did try to say that, you know, this is an iterative process. Because, you know, in order to do levels, you kind of have to have a good performance framework. And in order to have a good performance framework, you need to be doing calibrations. If you're not doing calibrations, which I'd be very, you know, I'm surprised if you're doing calibrations if you don't have leveling. So, you know, these things you need to be aware that, you know, they all are interconnected in the system. So the first thing we did is we did leveling first, and we tried to apply levels based on, you know, the information we did have around performance. We did that to the entire company, and we made that public to the individuals so they could see which level they were at. They could see the kind of tool that we'd used to do this rudimentary leveling. And then we started with our first round of performance calibrations based on our feedback mechanism that we have. During that first round of performance calibrations, we identified there was some leveling that needed to be changed. And then we can really confidently say, like, okay, we're happy with where our leveling is now. We really believe this is a good place. And then this mechanism that we have every 6 months should be able to kind of pick up any loose change that we have throughout recruitment or promotions or anything else that may happen.
So we did it maybe, like, I think that you all did it in a much more structured way than we did it. So I'm really happy to tell you, Ali. So we were so conscious about rollout that we literally, even in, like, you know, just after lockdown, we even pulled every employee into the office on the same day so that we could roll it out employee by employee as quickly as possible, so that there was the limited amount of time frame before one employee knew the level and the other employee knew the level. The other thing that we had is, like, it's a great point, Jeff, because what we did is we did leveling and salary at the same time. And when we rolled this out, we actually agreed that we were not going to downgrade anyone's salary based on the level that they actually had. So we actually had to sit down with people and say, hey, listen, your salary is level 13, but we think you're a level 11 now, but you're going to stay at a 13, but now you've got to catch up. So that was why it was so hard. And, like, we were so conscious of trying to roll this out extremely quickly and we literally had like 37 one-on-one meetings in the space of 2 days, where the CEO was in on the meeting, the direct line manager, so that they all got chance to say, like, I think you're right, I think you're wrong, how did you calculate this? And so, yeah, ironically, with us, we were terrified of going department by department and having a gap, because we were just thinking that gap might just cause anxiety, like, oh my God, yeah, I've got 2 weeks until I find out my level. That means something is wrong. And just, you know, just trying to limit that. But it was a crazy 2 days. It was a crazy 2 days.
All right. So just stop press. Really good discussion and great contribution, Mick. I think there's basically two pathways. Practically, it might make sense to go departmental by department. Basically, it's less workload to do it. But on the other side, you might also be aware that, you know what, you got to rip the Band-Aid at some point off, and maybe you just got to push it through and get it rolled out. And that will prevent, if you like, the leakage of information or the increase of anxiety going up. I think either way could potentially work. I guess you just got to read it, don't you? You got to kind of read the company atmosphere and maybe even ask them to say, hey, listen, we're going to do it, but do we do it departmental by department, or do we do it big bang? Very interesting. Okay, I don't like the idea of, like, not lowering anybody's salary. What if you've hired someone that is actually, you've over-recruited this person? They're not adequate for the job. And why should this person set the baseline? If we are true about leveling and we are committed to the idea of paying performance, should we not lower this person's salary if they are actually at the wrong level? Why isn't this a cop-out to keep it at, you know, to make them the baseline, or is it a cop-out we have to accept? Nicholas, go.
Well, so we're talking about legacy employees, basically. And I won't say they don't really matter, because if you're growing, most of your problem is with the market. So you want to make sure that you get to the market and you can address the market. If for some reason you have somebody whose salary is too high, there has to be a reason. And so from there on, you don't over-level them, but you have to determine, okay, are they solid enough that I can justify to everybody in the company that this is an exception, that their salary is not going to go up anymore now, whatever their performance? Or is that a problem of performance and I actually have somebody who's not delivering what they're supposed to be delivering, they need to go. But I think ultimately that's the decision you have to make. And this is where transparency again is a godsend, because it's the best way to make the good decisions, right? In a non-transparent system, you can hide and sweep everything under the rug and you know, take unethical decisions. But if you have the pressure of the whole company looking at what you're doing, and if you're really managing all of your policies like you everything would be could be forgotten at the copy machine, if that still exists, and for everybody to see, you don't make shitty decisions.
Yeah,
fully agree. I agree with this. 100%.
Accountability structures like help so much, and this is I think leads to what I think is a really important point, which is that managers should be really bought into the decisions and compensation philosophy that you're taking here, so that you can really make them accountable for decisions as well. Because ultimately, like, I think one of the worst things you can do for compensation transparency is have this to be like a HR thing that the HR team managers and the HR team are responsible for. And managers feel like, oh, well, fuck it. I'm just going to like negotiate an extra 15-20% here. And I'm going to do this other thing over there, because ultimately no one's going to point at the manager and say, why did you make these choices? But really having good accountability structures, I think really it, like, you know, transparency leads to accountability, and having accountability placed in the hands of managers means that managers are going to know that they have to make good decisions in order to make sure their team respects them, and will stay and be, you know, long-term happy employees with them.
I mean, if I can just add, I think you're making such a good point. And one thing I want to, like, especially for the audience, because I think when we launched this out, a lot of the reaction was like, this is like a great employer branding play. Everyone thought about employee benefit, transparency, employees feel better, but there are genuine business benefits to doing this. And one of the great ones for us was that, you know, sometimes like misalignment between two team members doing the same thing in terms of salary is not because a company is trying to squeeze money. It's because sometimes managers are overloaded and they are not thinking about keeping that alignment all the time. So what we did at Traffic, we were, like they said, like 37 people. And I love transparency because there's no way now that can ever happen again, that I let, as a manager, one of my team who were brave enough to ask for a pay rise versus the one that wasn't, ever be out of sync. So it actually does me a huge favor because I don't have to constantly be thinking like, oh my goodness, am I paying Peter enough money? You know, does Jane get the right salary? Because it's almost like crowdsourcing the keep everything in order. So it actually works really well for me and saves me a ton of like brain effort, just by having the team manage their own salaries.
Well, this is an interesting one, isn't it, folks? Just to ask the crowd here, this seems to me like a manager positive move, right? To go to a salary transparent environment seems to me like a manager positive move, in the sense it takes away from me the responsibility to negotiate the damn salary with this person. Or we all often have a malcontent in the business that is always every year knocking on a door saying, I want this, that, and the other. I can say, hey, listen, we have a calculator. We calculate the rate. It's not on me, Mr. or Mrs. You deal with it. I think that's a relief, isn't it, folks? Like I say, probably in the past, we kind of got away with it because managers, if they were managing their own P&L, oftentimes had the incentive to hire at a lower rate than they could, then you know, basically hire what they could get away with, because you might get basically better ROI. Now we can take that away by going the salary transparent route. That's the one of the obvious things that seems to emerge from all of this.
Do you know what happened? I just want to, just 1 second, because Annie, you mentioned this before about trying to go after the big leaguers in the companies that are paying a lot now. For those who are like familiar with the startup space, what we find now is that companies are willing to pay way above market average for a salary for someone in the tech space, but just to get them in the door. And then, you know, that person gets a big salary and then they have to stay on that salary for 3 years. So what we got by going transparent is I've got like 3 team members at Traffic who joined taking a lower offer with us because they knew what was next. So I didn't have to show them that big salary, but I said, hey, listen, if you deliver like you said you deliver in 1 year, you're going to be a pass. So it actually helped us attract talent away from those people that spend huge money on the market at the first position. I could say to those people in interview, that's a great offer. Do you know what the next level is in that company? And they were like, actually, no, I don't. And it was like it was a game changer for us as well for attracting talent.
Really, really good point, folks. I think a lot of recruiters looking at this were thinking, oh my goodness, salary transparency is going to cause me a problem closing candidates. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying, Mick, is that actually with a transparent culture, you can actually put the career path in and say, you know what, it's this number now, but we can tell you it's going to be this number. Yeah. If you hit your performance measures, it isn't some invention, or it isn't the manager that has the full control to be able to, you know, determine your career path in that way. So I think there's a way in which you can we can turn this into a, as you say, an advantage from recruiting. Matt, you're about to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say we've actually seen a couple of companies that we talked about this, and they were like, "Can we just expose our compensation calculator and our progression pathways on our careers page?" And we were like, "Yeah, there's nothing stopping you." Right? and they went about it. So actually, people could see, they could dive in, and they'd be like, "Okay, cool. This is what the banding looks like here. This is what that like the expectations are of me at this level. Like I've got clarity." Like, you know, it's not just the manager selling me the dream and the recruiter being like, this place is all rainbows and wonder. Instead, you're like, okay, here's a clear set of expectations. Here's a clear line on comp. I know that actually working here, I can expect transparency to probably be more prevalent across every piece of communication within the business, not just on the comp, not just on the progression. And I agree with you, from an attraction perspective, for a lot of people, that's going to be far more attractive than the opacity that you often see in places.
Very good. Okay, just a quick question. It's just popped in my mind. I'm going to just share it with you, though. Has anybody got any experience of actually lowering someone's salary, and is that even legal to do?
There's a lot of places it's not legal. But I think it's really past the point. I mean, the main point is you don't want to lower somebody's salary because they've already proven to you that they can get that salary. And so if you want to keep them, don't do that. If you want to let them go, do that. But if you want to keep them long term, doesn't make sense in my opinion.
Yep.
We set a timeline for one employee. So we said like 12 months and then catch up. So we also kind of gave a catch up period as well to let them prove themselves.
That's really interesting, Mick. We're going to dive into all, by the way, folks, the reason why I'm chopping this sort of fast is because time is running out. And this is obviously a series we need to do. And in fact, I will be talking about compensation a lot more in the course of this year. So we'll definitely start bringing some of you guys back. Folks, we always do this in the middle of every show. It's actually at the end of the show, but we're going to do it anyway. Don't let Brain Food Live be the place where you start a conversation and it stops because we have to come off air. Please do continue the conversation with other people that are also interested in this topic, which all of you are because you're watching it right now. So this is the point where you take a moment and just share your LinkedIn profile in the chat stream or in the comment thread, wherever you're watching it, and just connect with everyone you see on that thread. This is the way in which you could just basically interact with people that are already dealing with this problem. So don't try and like stew around by yourself trying to fix all this. People have gone ahead and have done this. Go and talk to them, go and connect with them, and just build up your network of people that care about salary transparency and compensation. Let's share those links, folks. And we need to hit the questions. So we're gonna go there right away, okay? Now, I'm not going to ask everyone because we don't have the time. So I'll just pick a name of person. You're going to have to try and deal with this, okay? Leah said, what tool or source do you use for salary benchmarking? I will actually open this out to everyone. Give me one tool that basically works for salary benchmarking. Is there such a thing? Does this make sense?
We use Radford. We used Radford, but it's not great. They're not super great for startups and tech. So yeah, I think there's probably a lot better tools out there.
Okay, cool. Anybody want to volunteer? What tool?
Mercer Contrix on our end.
Yep. Can you share that in the chat stream, Nick, if you can?
Sure.
Go ahead.
I share ERI, which is what we use.
Yep. Mick, what do you use?
So we in Poland, where we are based, we've got two companies that launch reports every year, and then we fact check them. So I'll drop one in called InHire, like a great company for local Poland. Yeah.
Perfect. How about you, Matt? I mean, I know you, it's something you might advise companies on. Do you want to volunteer something?
Option Impact and Radford. Option Impact's better for startups. It's free. Radford costs you a lot, particularly if you're international. And then, of course, there's the thing called Heron.app.
Okay, you can share Heron.app in there as long as you also put in the other two businesses you mentioned. Exactly. Stick them into the chat stream. Okay, there you go, folks. A big list ready to go. Let's go to the next one. Was the change in your company driven by leadership or from TA? How did you get buy-in across the business? Generally, where did it come from? Did it come from us or did it come from somewhere else?
Asking from our employees. Employees were asking for it over the leadership or recruiters.
Okay, interesting.
It came from me, a COO, so that answers that question.
Yep.
Yeah, for top down, me and the CEO here at Trafford, we wanted to implement it and then implemented it down.
Cool. And it kind of makes sense. It comes from sea level, right? Without that buy-in at the top, it's not happening. So it generally will emerge from there, although I think TA could probably introduce the idea and maybe sell the story internally at the sea level. Okay, going on, Glenn is saying, how do you encourage candidates to apply who want a higher salary than what is advertised? I've lost count of the number of successful hires who have asked for more money than we originally decided to pay for the role. So Glenn's saying, you know what, we might advertise the role at this number, and eventually we've paid them more because they've got interested, we've got them in and we've persuaded them. How do we do that? I guess the answer is we don't, isn't it? Like we can't because we've literally published a salary.
We have an approach at Whereby that I think is kind of controversial for some people. So I'll tell you what we do. So we have a minimum threshold that we pay. So we say like the minimum is like £55,000 for an engineer. And then we will have 10% that we have room above that, we're hiring managers and the TA person or the people partner make the decision. So as long as it's in that 10%, we're all good. 20% that their budget owner needs to approve it, and there needs to be like a documented reason on their job profile as to why. So it's like they're a designer as well as an engineer and that skills we didn't expect, so it's worth more money, or they came from a competitor or something else. And anything above 20% needs to have a documented reason approved by the C-suite. So we do have people that are paid like pretty significantly above what we'd consider like our band, which is just a single number, but there's like a very clearly documented reason why we're doing that, and for us that actually works really well. It gives us like quite a lot of flexibility, and it also gives our managers quite a lot of autonomy, but I could definitely see why that would be controversial to some, because it's, you know, it really is putting a lot of trust into our managers to make good decisions. But I believe we have the accountability structures in place there that they kind of have to.
Yep, that's great. So there's ways and means, Glenn. I would recommend just following some of Jess's posts on that. I think there's a lot of detail in how that's operating. Okay, Sean's asked the question, if you're publishing bands and not individual comp, what is the best practice on the breadth of those bands? Is it like, is it consistent, or is it a log scale? How does it work? Did you do $5,000 a pop? How does it work?
I'd say go as narrow as you can without making exceptions. I mean, the key point in transparency, yes, is you don't want to make exceptions, otherwise people's trust in your system will drop. And so really, you need to have bands that will allow you to function on the market. But they need to be as narrow as possible. So we have 16 levels, which means we have pretty narrow bands, actually. I think we have 725 down, 725 up in percentage. And that's meant to cover the breadth of our range.
Yep, cool. Some really good basic levers here. So in other words, the more exceptions you make, you have a decline in trust, unless you have like a very sophisticated way of explaining the exceptions. And you want to go narrow and more levels rather than few levels and then big bands, I guess. So hopefully that's helped, Sean. Okay, just battering through these questions here. John saying, do you define and share role competencies and levels with internal and external candidates? So in other words, is there consistency between the internal and external?
Absolutely.
Nodding, yes. The answer is yes, John. Okay, Hugo saying, okay, we go externally transparent. We offer better salary than the competition. Great. We might have a wave up here in joiners. What about the opposite case? Okay, so in other words, what if you don't get any more applicants? Well, I guess that's a different issue, isn't it? You've got to find another way to hire those people. So Hugo, that is obviously an issue, but that's probably not a comp issue per se, or at least it's a recruitment marketing issue. And maybe from your leveling point of view, like, are you actually hiring at the right level according to the market compensation? Okay, final question. What is the biggest company you know that has the high level of pay transparency? So I think Annika's mentioned this a couple of times, and I think this goes back to the number question we mentioned. Is there an example of a company that has got high level of pay transparency? So let's say the Jess model, let's say something like that. What is the biggest company that's done that? Does anyone know?
BBC,
yeah,
a lot of public sector have done this, actually. A lot of public sector have done it, Annika. So they essentially have done it on the public sector side. Although an argument might be part of the thing that's happened with that transparency happening on public sector is maybe an overall depression of salary levels. So that is another thing we need to talk about. We don't have the time for it. But Annika, I totally get where you're coming from. maybe it's a conversation we need to have on episode 2. How do you do pay transparency in a megacorp? Okay, that's about it, folks. We are running out of time. We've gone over time, actually. So I want to just take a moment to thank everyone for watching and thank all of our amazing guests for spending a bit of time and sharing their knowledge with us. An example of transparency right here. So Matt Bradburn, thank you very much for joining us. Great to see you, sir. Jessica, good to see you. Good luck in your move to New York. Hopefully we'll catch up at some point, either New York or elsewhere. Mick, great to see you also. Thanks for fiddling with the camera and getting onto the screen. And Nicholas, thank you so much for your very interesting and insightful commentary, and also for your perseverance on the technical side. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I didn't say goodbye to Annie, and I was going to just have a chat with her, but she's disappeared. But never mind. Annie Jackson, thank you very much for being co-host. Okay, listen, thank you everyone for watching. I hope you've got value from that. I thought that was really quite interesting. And in fact, it just told me that there's a lot more I need to do in terms of learning about salary transparency. You know, it's a much more complicated project than I initially anticipated. So anyway, make sure you follow all of the people who were in the show. I think they're obviously essential people to know. Okay, that's about it, everybody. We are back. I think next week we are going to be talking mega scale hiring. Yes, we're all used to hiring 20, 30, maybe even 100 people per year. What about hiring 10,000 people a year? What does that look like, folks? Can you operate the same tools, techniques, and processes when you're doing hiring at mega scale? So if you're interested in a totally different type of recruitment that you still need to do, then make sure you register for the show. Follow the channel if you like this type of conversation. We do this every week. We'll be back next Friday in normal time. Okay, that's about it. Thanks for watching.